It was a painful and difficult decision. They met for hours and hours, meeting after meeting, year after year. They deliberated and they debated. They calculated and cogitated. They opined and they orated. They harangued and they harumphed. They prayed about it. Their ministers preached about it. Should they or shouldn't they? It was a difficult, painful, fraught decision. In fact, it was so difficult, so painful, so fraught, it took them over 10 years to even bring it to a vote. And even then, the vote was anything but unanimous. 20 voted against, 40 voted for. 20 of the brethren voted against this very meeting house, this newfangled meeting house, this over-the-top meeting house, this very building we are in. 20 of the brethren voted against it. 20 of them were adamant that the old one, the first one, the cedar meeting house, was more than adequate. To be sure, it must be expanded to accommodate a burgeoning congregation. After all, it was a fact that the aisles were strewn with chairs and stools and benches to accommodate all the people that were in here for worship. In the early 1700s, the place was bursting at the seams. So 20 voted against this meeting house, but 40 voted for the new meeting house. They voted in favor of it, and so they would build it. That was just the beginning. Then they had to decide whether to build it out of wood, as was the former meeting house, or perhaps out of brick, or maybe out of stone. Well, that took a while to decide. More meetings, more deliberation. But that wasn't all. Then they had to decide whether to build here, right here in this spot, which meant tearing down the old meeting house, which had served them so well for 60 years, where their children had been baptized, where their parents had been buried, where they had prayed and sung and met their God. And demolishing the old meeting house was painful enough on its own, but to add insult to injury, it would mean that they would be without a home, without a meeting house for about a year. Painful, difficult decision. In the end, over the protestations of many, including, notably, over the protestation of one of their most prominent members, Justice Sewell, they voted in favor of demolishing the old to make way for the new. But that wasn't all. In fact, painful as those past 10 years and all those deliberations had been, they were as nothing compared to what still lay ahead. What yet faced them, a matter that must be settled well before the meeting house was completed, was a peculiar New England custom. No evidence of anything like it back in England. What faced them yet was a two-step procedure. Step one, dignifying the seats. Dignifying the seats. And step two, seating the meeting house. Step one, dignifying the seats. This was the process of assigning ranks or dignities to each and every seat in the meeting house. In the earliest manifestations of this process, the most prestigious seats were those closest to the pulpit, nearest to the pulpit. These seats ranked higher, and the further away from the pulpit, the lower the rank or dignity the seat was. The least prestigious of all, those of the lowest rank, those in the far-flung reaches of the gallery, the upper gallery. It was to the gallery that children were assigned. As well, I am ashamed to say, two other groups, those who were native to this land, Indians, and those who had been kidnapped and carried here from Africa against their will. It is likely that in the cedar meeting house, the one that preceded this, The men and women sat apart from each other, the men to the minister's right, the women to the minister's left, and the aisle in the middle was called the Broad Alley or the Grace Alley. Young unmarried men, you. Young unmarried women, you. I wonder what they looked at during worship. And to keep them at a safe distance from each other, in the middle, the children, Indians, and servants and slaves. And up there, in the children's gallery, was also the tithing man, who watched over the children with an eagle's eye for any mischief, any insolence, or even mere lack of attention. Now, the tithing man was a paid position in the Puritan community. Benjamin Franklin's father was a tithing man of this church. It was a tithing man's job to enforce the rules of the Sabbath. He collected taxes paid to the church. He fined those who skipped worship without good reason. And he kept order in the meeting house with a stick. He would use one end to bop misbehaving children on the head or to poke elderly gentlemen who had fallen asleep. And at the other end was a feather by which he would tickle women to wakefulness or attention. And soldiers sat here and here in the upper galleries with their weapons armed, able to see the doors if anyone should enter. By 1730, however, by the time of this meeting house, men and women were no longer separated by the broad alley. Families could sit together, and the assigning of rank or dignities to each pew had taken on somewhat more nuance, and I'll return to that in a moment. So once the seats had been dignified, there followed step two, the practice of seating the meeting house. Seating the meeting house was the practice of assigning seats to the congregation according to one's worth. Not one's financial means, one's worthiness, as our Puritan forebears judged these things. In the 16 and 1700s, the peculiar Puritan practice of seating the meeting house required that the seating committee, which was composed in this case in 1730 to prepare for the seating of this meeting house, it was composed of three men assigned to that job by the two ministers of the church. The seating committee assigned seats according to status. They would assign you your seats according to your status as they perceived it. It was the delicate and fearsome task of this committee to assign status according to the following, what they called grounds of advancement: age, dignity of descent, place of public trust, pious disposition, estate, and peculiar serviceableness of any kind. Status, therefore, was not adduced purely by wealth, and that's the thing here. You could not buy a seat in this meeting house. The best seats were assigned by the seating committee to those who held a special place, a special status, a godly sort of worth, as our Puritan forebears judged these things. Friends, do you see the peril in this process? The dangers, the hazards, the potential for injury and harm. If you were assigned to serve on this seating committee today, how would you, for instance, begin to measure the status, say, of the Davis Merrifield family against that of the Spitzer Youngs, or the Johnson Fertillos compared with the Jackson Adams, or the Pitchers compared with the Yeos, or the Metalides compared with the Hollands, or the Boltons with that of Mr. Bowers, the Corman Vogans, or the Butlers, the Briggs, the Bulkleys, the Blacks, the Baileys, the Boats, the Bergstressers, the Greggs, the Hands, the Harus, the Hodgkins, the Castorcos, you get it. Now, some of you have decided that, you know, for instance, over here we have the Burks and the Monsmiths, who apparently think that they're of some equal worth. The the sterns and the oars have assigned their own sense of rank to one another. Back here, Mrs. Andrews, Mrs. Murphy, Dr. Blake are sitting together. Now, the seating committee might well take issue with this self-definition. How would you begin to assign pride of place among these persons and these families with whom you live every day of your lives? If you were on to serve on such a committee, how might you weight pious disposition against peculiar serviceableness, against place of public trust? Do you see the peril in the process? It was a delicate and perilous matter indeed, and the ministers prayed, therefore, earnestly and fervently that this seating of the meeting house in 1730 would not be the undoing of the congregation. Seating the meeting house was serious business. Large fines could be assessed against people found willingly sitting in seats of too great honor. In one case, a member of the congregation not only sat out of place, but had the temerity to place an easy chair right near the pulpit and to sit in it himself. The congregants were so enraged by this affront to the social order, they not only fined the offending member, they carted his chair outside and they hung it on a hemlock tree. But here's the thing. In this peculiar and perilous undertaking, the Puritans were attempting something, in fact, far more democratic and equitable than they had known back in England. They were determined to measure worth not on the basis of royalty or aristocracy or wealth only, but rather on the basis of those qualities and graces they deemed of a higher order, like piety and serviceableness and public trust. It was possible, therefore, that any person who had been born without great pedigree or without money could rise to a higher dignity. Well, not quite anybody if you were male and white and landowning, but if given that, you could rise to a higher dignity through your own piety, or because you've earned the trust of others, or because you had some gift that you offered that was so important to the commonwealth of the people. In the end, however, this peculiar, perilous Puritan practice could not be sustained. It was simply too fraught. Weighing the relative worthiness of one family over against another proved to be too complicated and too vexing to be sustained. Already then, by the Revolutionary War, throughout the colony, seating the meeting house had devolved to a basis everyone could understand: money. By the Revolutionary War, if you could afford the most prestigious pew, you could have it. Now, if you look at the first seating plan for this meeting house, which is the second seating plan, really, of the congregation, the first seating house, seating plan for this meeting house, built in 1730, you will note unassigned pews up front, and quite a few of them. These were left free for visiting dignitaries, of which this very important congregation had many. And if you note the assignment of the Sewell's boxes, there are two boxes that would be back in this corner to the left-hand side of your page, sort of over there. The seating here is not actually as it was in 1730. It's a something of an approximation. But there's two boxes assigned to the Sewells. And it is likely, one wonders why they would be back so far, this highly prominent congregation, it is likely that they sat in pews that were raised. And so what we're seeing here is an adaptation or nuancing of the dignifying of the seats. So by 1730, at least in this meeting house, those seats closest to the pulpit were no longer of the highest rank. Now think of prestigious boxes at a sporting arena or an opera house, in which the best seating, the seating for royalty or the person who owns the team, are not those closest to the action, down with, frankly, the hoi polloi, but rather those seats at a safe, private, dignified, and elevated remove. Like the Queen at Royal Albert Hall, therefore, the Sewells boxes are elevated and behind the others. Like the Queen, the Sewells could look out upon over the heads of lesser mortals, and the lesser mortals could only look upon the Sewells if they craned their necks and looked backward. Now the Puritans came to the soil looking for a place, a home, a homeland. Their peculiar practices of dignifying the seats and of seating the meeting house were how they made a home for themselves on a basis of what they thought of as godliness. Like the Israelites after whom they modeled themselves, the Puritans and the Pilgrims experienced affliction and oppression in a former land. And as they would tell us, like the Israelites, they too cried out to the Lord. As the Lord heard the cries of the Israelites in Egypt, so did our God hear the cries of these serious and pious Christians who wanted nothing but to worship God in their own freedom. As they would tell it, God saw their affliction and brought them up out of the lands of England and Europe with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm, and brought them to this place and gave them this land, a land which for them was flowing with milk and honey. And the whole sweep of Israel's history is a story of homecoming, the journey from the status of stranger to that of citizen, from alien to resident, from outsider to one who belongs. So too is the whole sweep of our history a story of homecoming, an anxiousness to find a place to belong. And as Israel was instructed, as we heard in the reading today, as Israel was instructed to pause each year and to recite their history, to give thanks to God, so too do we return annually to this meeting house, our ancestral home, to remember and recite our history. In so doing, we confess that which is shameful, and we embrace that which is good. And in all things, we turn to the author of the universe, our leader triumphant, both glad and chastened, with a mixture both of humility and deep gratitude. And the people said, Amen.